You're listening to First Words, a podcast for parents and writers. Thank you for joining us as we explore the messy space where creativity, career, and kids collide. We're your hosts, Jasmine Aluma.
And I'm Casey Gates Fry.
I met Anne Terpstra when she joined my writers group back in 2018. Anne is an award-winning Chicago-based writer who tells heartfelt, sex-positive stories that are grounded in realism and center LGBTQ+ characters. Her debut women's fiction novel, Beyond Any Experience, was released this past May with Nine Star Press.
On their first date, Olivia had receded physically, folding inward until she became a silhouette of the woman Ellie first met. But visit by visit, her body had unfurled, and tonight they settled on the love seat to huddle under a blanket. Fat white flakes swooped beyond the low wall. The small square of porch felt timeless, as if they were figures in a snow globe. At their backs, a tiny sealed-off house. Beyond the slurring snow, a sphere of glass. Ellie removed her gloves and slid her left hand into Olivia's right, lacing their fingers. The quiet suspension was intimate, seductive. But more and more, she wondered what existed for them beyond the fragile border of this enclosed world.
In addition to being an author, Anne is a skilled potter and photographer.
Anne was working in theater in Northern California when she began to explore fiction writing. She met her wife, who was then in a medical residency in Chicago. As their relationship grew, Anne decided to move to Chicago with the intention of writing a book. When Anne and her wife decided to adopt a child, she was prepared for a long waiting period, with plenty of time to get her ideas down. Within a month of submitting their portfolio to the adoption agency, they were selected.
What I would love to hear first is I would love for you to tell us about the moment you met your son.
Well, he's adopted. And so we were there in the room when his birth mother was giving birth. And so we met him as soon as he came out, basically. I was a lot, obviously, all at once because, you know, we were doing this in a shared space with this young woman that we, you know, very much wanted to honor. But we were also very excited to meet him and have him come out. I don't know, powerful moment, but also very humbling and kind of overwhelming all at the same time. Probably not so different from the birth experience, I suppose, if you carry as well. But definitely sort of from an exterior view. He was very purple and very mad and very and was, you know, just a loud, crying, cute, you know, baby. And we were just like, we kind of jokingly referred to him as a poof baby because we found out kind of quickly that this was going to happen. And so we were like, oh yeah, we're hanging out. We put in our papers, you know, it might be a while because we're two women. You have to be patient. And then it was just like, hey, here's a baby. I mean, not literally, obviously, but it happened really quickly. So we went from sort of zero to parenthood in the span of basically a month. Very humbling and very, I don't know, it's hard to put into words, but sharing that experience with someone who is kind of sharing themselves with you in terms of his birth mother and his birth parents, you're just very cognizant that, that you're part of sort of a larger process. And we were grateful for that and grateful for her and for him.
What was that transition to parenthood like for you?
Abrupt, but I was always going to be the stay-at-home parent. We knew that. You know, my wife is a physician and, you know, income-wise and everything, it made the most sense. So we had planned that going in. However, we came to parenthood. So I was ready for that. You know, it wasn't like a surprise or anything. You know, it was he was a super chill baby. He slept, he ate, you know, it was all of those things. So but it's that thing they always say about parenthood, the days feel like forever and the years are really short, you know, mm-hmm. And that was definitely true. Where you're just like, wow, we are still doing this, you know? So there's a weird mix of like, it's really fun and super monotonous when they're newborns. And then when they get a little older, you know, and they have a little more personality, they can kind of interact with you. It's a little different. The other thing that was hard is it was pretty socially isolating, only because it happened so quickly. We didn't have any like mom groups, no meetups, nothing like that. We just kind of, we were the first of our friends to have children. So it kind of threw me out into this experience that I didn't have much of a net to land into or people to sort of turn into. And I had babysat a lot. So being with babies, being around babies, all of that part was fine. I'm in the middle of a stretch of cousins. So, you know, none of that was unusual, but I didn't really have a peer group to land with right out of the gate. And that was probably the hardest thing about it. You know, he was pretty easy, but all the stuff around that was a little more challenging, a little more isolating than I was really prepared for.
And at that time, I just want to clarify, you had been living in Chicago for how long?
Well, I was been there about 4 years.
What was your creative life like in those early parenting years?
It was minimal because we adopted so quickly. I was like, I felt like it's like 6 months, and then it was like, oh, you know, I kind of pulled my head up. I think like a lot of writers, you have this idea that, oh, when they're babies, they're sleeping, I'm going to write. And, you know, no. and I basically just set writing aside for a time because that's kind of what absorbed our world. And really the thing that kind of got me back into creative life again was pottery, because I had been, he was like two and a half. And I was just in that stage of like, I got to get out of the house. I have to do something. And I had always liked the idea of wheel throwing. I'd never tried it. It just seemed cool. So I signed up for a park district class and really loved it. And for several years, I wasn't doing any writing, but I really feel like having something to do with my hands and being creative in a different way was led me back to writing. And it, even now, still, I still throw. And it's really great having something that you enjoy doing, even if you're not that great at it, with your hands. I find creatively, like if writing is my only creative thing, it gets a little, I mean, it's a little isolating. You're staring at a screen, you know, it's just, there's things I really love about it, but it's also a process that I need a break from sometimes.
And like your brain is so fried in those early years too, that like using your brain, like switching gears is so hard.
You're focused on that one thing. It's meditative, you know, and my brain doesn't really wander much when I'm doing it. I'm just thinking about what I'm doing with my hands. When you're fried and you can't put a sentence together, you don't have to talk. You can just be silent, but work. So there was a lot of value in that early on.
So I am a stay-at-home mom myself, and my daughter is 17 months, and I kind of have this like idea of like, ah, when she's school-aged, everything is going to open up. And so I'm kind of curious to know for you, how did you imagine your creative life changing when your son reached kindergarten? And did it change, or was it different than what you expected?
It was very different. One of the things that happened, you know, before our son turned one, he was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. And so that changed everything in some ways. And we knew then that, you know, the amount of therapies and the travel, like that wasn't something you could sort of like farm out. You know what I mean? Like we had to have someone with a really flexible schedule, me. So even just the idea of going back to work or something like that was off the table. So I had this vague idea that kindergarten, or like, I think he went to 1 year preschool, but would be that, you know, those steps towards that, because he gets around, he could access, you know, school physically and all that. It just wasn't a good fit, you know, public school. And so we weren't there very long before we decided to homeschool. But when you have a kid who's disabled, you know, the path just looks different every time. And it's different for each kind of parent with each kind of kid, even, you know, like my experience doesn't look like some other parent's experience with a child with disabilities. So that was kind of a game changer for us.
Yeah. And was that decision to homeschool, did that sort of feel like the only option? Did you consider other things? I don't know if there were other things to consider. And then I'm also curious how making that decision felt in the beginning when you made it and started implementing that into your lives.
It was a quick decision based on circumstances at school that became untenable, is what I'll say about that. So there wasn't a lot of planning that went into it initially. It was a reaction to a difficult situation. But, you know, it's been the best thing. It's one of those things you learn as you go. I certainly have had, you know, mistakes and things that I would do differently looking back, but a lot of successes as well. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of planning going in, but we kind of made it up as we went along. I was obviously the primary homeschooling parent, but my wife was extremely supportive as well and tried to pitch in. It's funny because it just completely reframed education for me, because I was the kid who did well in school and it was easy and I didn't have any behavioral issues and teachers never gave me a hard time. And like, it just didn't register for me that you didn't go to public school, because I went to public school and it was fine. And my wife went to public school and it was fine. When your kid doesn't fit that sort of middle of the road picture, you just realize it's not really fine. It was just fine because I was middle of the road, you know, and I didn't challenge or demand anything outside of what they're prepared to give. We've homeschooled ever since, is all I can say. And it's been really successful. He's in high school now. One of the big steps is, you know, you get to a certain stage and you start paying other people. Like his math skills. I'm like, dude, I got you to pre-algebra. That is as much as this former theater kid and journalism major can do for you. You know, and he's excellent at computer science, and he's always had mentors in those areas, well ahead of anything. I mean, we're not computer people at all. So, I mean, it was a whole different world, but homeschooling, I think some people come into it. They're like, I'm going to homeschool my kid. And they know that, like, when they give birth, they're like, this is what we're going to do as a family. And we just weren't one of those families, but we've really embraced it. If you don't have a disabled kid, it's really difficult to know sort of what the other side of that fence feels like. But you often end up, you're the center of attention while being simultaneously excluded, both the child and the parent. And I guess I would just say for people who fall more in the abled world, just spend some time thinking about that. And sort of inclusiveness and how to welcome kids and parents who don't always fit kind of the obvious or the easy or the expected. Because I can tell you the people on the other side of that fence feel it and see it, that exclusion. So this is just more of an emotional request that if you haven't lived through that, maybe read a few memoirs. Taylor Harris's is a really wonderful recent one. But sort of get a sense of what that world looks like when not everyone in your house falls in sort of the abled community. What does that look like to be on the other side of the fence? Because there were a lot of things I didn't know. There's a lot of things I learned, challenged some of my own expectations and like prejudices. And I mean, there's just stuff you don't know until you live through it. I don't know. It's a different experience. So I would just say to all parents, you know, we're all in it together in some ways, but it can feel like you're not for some people. And if you can make that easier, then I think some parents and kids would find it really helpful. Being a queer parent, I mean, you stick out a little bit, but we live in Chicago intentionally. You know, we put ourselves in an urban environment where we felt both included and safe. So, I mean, yes, you know, you do stand out, but I think probably other queer parents have felt some of that a little more than we have just because of the location where they might live. But it's always something that's on your mind. For the longest time, my son thought the word spouse meant two women because he'd heard us use it, but he didn't realize it worked for men and women. And I should correct my language a little bit, too, that and I can't give credit because I can't remember who said this that I read the first time, but they said the best way to refer to yourself if you're not disabled is either not yet disabled or non-disabled, because almost everyone ends up disabled at some point, either temporarily, you know, if you suffer an injury of some sort or old age, you know, where everybody kind of reaches that thing. So that's a term I've been trying to use more because I think it is a more reflective way to look at that experience and a good reminder that, you know, we're all able, so to speak, until we aren't. Flat on his belly among his Legos, Ben was building red walls 4 bricks high, blue walls 5 bricks high, and yellow walls 6 bricks high, a pattern he'd followed for years. A fierce protectiveness overtook Olivia. He wasn't the kind of child the world expected. He wasn't even the child they had expected, back when she whispered knock-knock jokes through Sophia's growing belly. But he was exactly who he was meant to be, and he was theirs.
And then, so from kindergarten to now in high school, you know, you went from not doing much, being able to do much creatively to at some point in that, you know, span of time, starting to reintegrate writing back into your life. And so I would love to hear a little bit about that transition or what things started opening up and what kind of shifts took place for that to become part of your life again.
You know, it's funny, just after I turned 40, I just had this idea for a book in my head. And I hadn't really thought about writing for a while. And literally just in car rides, you know, taking your kids places, you know, that kind of thing. It was sort of turning in my head for probably a couple of years. And then just after my 42nd birthday, I turned to my wife and I was just like, this is going to sound weird, but I have this idea for a book. I can see it all in front of me. I'm going to try to write it. But don't tell anybody else because I hadn't finished one in so long that it's one of those things that, you know, if you can get through an essay or a short story, like you've got this little thing that you finished and you're like, it's done, you know, but a book is this huge thing. And if it's not finished, it feels very like a failure or like you haven't accomplished something, which I realize is short-sighted because, you know, 60,000 words is an accomplishment, whether it ends up being a book or not. But that, you know, it's hard to get past that mindset when you haven't finished one. So I just, by longhand, and I have terrible handwriting, longhand, I wrote the first draft of the book in like a month.
And whoa.
It was very rough. And the book now that I have that's coming out is, I mean, some of the scenes are still very similar in terms of structure. Some of it's completely different. But I did that in like a month. And then in 4 or 5 months, I had a draft typed up that looked bookish. you know, I typed it up initially on my son's really heavy, ancient, old, like PC laptop. And my wife got so tired of watching me drag it around and try to get it places to like coffee shops while he was at, not after school class, but, you know, we signed him up for different classes and activities. And I bring that along that she was just like, we're getting you a smaller laptop. That thing is a behemoth. So we got a very like small light Mac, one of the little, like the tiniest one you can buy. It's really portable, mm-hmm. which works great for typing. Yeah, I was 42 and a half, I guess. And that's when I sort of started to try to figure out, like, what do you do when you want to publish a book? Getting an agent. I mean, I knew generally what the idea was of it, but like I signed up for Twitter. It's just like, oh, okay, we're doing Twitter now. And, you know, trying to figure all this stuff out. I had not been on social media until I finished the book. Like, didn't have a Facebook account. Had never been on it. Just hadn't really interested me. But I met some really lovely people through it, you know, including Jasmine. So it has its benefits as well. So that's kind of what got it started, was that just, I kind of made up my mind I was going to get through it. And in terms of process, I mean, having a supportive spouse is everything when you have a kid, you know, because they have to be able to take them at times. And, you know, my wife and I have always had a very balanced, equal relationship. There's none of that, like, she's babysitting and I'm the parent. Like, she's always stepped up. She's always been there. I mean, obviously, I put the more time in because she works. But, you know, if she's here, she's present and she's a parent. And we've been really, really fortunate to prioritize our relationship through all of this. And so just having her say, yeah, you know, go do this, get out of the house, go do this, I've got this, you know, that kind of time is really valuable.
Yeah. And so just to make sure, when you were 42 and you decided this was the time, how old was your son at that point?
He would have been 10. At that age, you know, a little more independent, you can do a few drop off classes, you know, that kind of thing. Get some breaks during the day to kind of work in little 1-2 hour snatches, you know, that kind of thing. But I didn't have that option of like, I'm dropping off at school at 7:30 and now I've got time until 3. It was more piecemeal than that.
And what does your son think about your identity as a writer?
You know, he thinks it's fine. He didn't mean it as a joke, but he's one of those like blunt kids. And he was just like, I feel like you've been editing this book way longer than you were writing it. I'm like, yeah, that's accurate. That's accurate. Yeah. He just thinks this whole publishing thing, like you have to get an agent and then that person has to let you get like try to convince someone else to get your, he just thinks the whole structure is real redundant and dumb.
you know, you're like, you're not wrong.
No, but he's supportive in the way that a teenage boy is supportive of his, you know, mom doing something. I think the pottery in some ways is easier for him because it's this physical object he can look at. Or photography. I do photography as well, and I've kind of gotten him into it. You know, we can talk about a picture, pottery I can hold up, and he'd be like, oh, I like that glaze or whatever. He doesn't read what I write. And so it's a little more like abstract, you know, for him.
I think as the whole impetus for this podcast is the intersection of being a parent and a writer. And I would love to know how being a parent has affected or impacted your writing.
Hugely. I wouldn't have written the book I've written that's coming out if I hadn't been a parent. In some ways, I see that sort of long gap in my 30s of not writing as a boon, because I think in my 20s, a lot of my writing was sort of focused on like the coming out process and trying to process that for myself. And, you know, where does that all fit in? And then the 30s sort of gave me some time and maturity to kind of say, you know, what do I really want to write about? You know, and who I was at 42 is very different in some ways than who I was at 28 when I was, you know, writing. And, you know, by the time I sort of picked my head up and was like, I want to write something, I wanted to write something where I could see myself. And finding queer women over 40 who are parents and have some experience with disability, I mean, good luck, you know? And that isn't a memoir. And I'm not saying that to put down memoirs. I'm just saying, like, that's where I have found myself. Taylor Harris has a beautiful book out right now, This Boy We Made, that really resonated with me. But in fiction work, sort of see any of those experiences reflected is very difficult. I wanted to see myself. I wanted to see people that I knew, you know, through experiences with my son who had gone through similar things. You know, I just wanted to see all that in a fiction book. So it was a huge impact because this book wouldn't exist without me being a parent and being a parent to a kid who, you know, doesn't sort of fall in the middle of the road. And I mean, I think it's changed even what I want to write in the future. Not everything necessarily is focused on parenthood, you know, every time, but just middle-aged women, you know, queer women always. In some ways, parenthood was the thing that kind of gave me the hook that got me back into writing, although I didn't know it at the time, obviously.
And how has being a writer impacted who you are as a parent?
I think you're a better parent when not everything is about your kid. And I don't know that every parent would agree with me when I say that, because I do know some who are just like, it's all my kids all the time. And if that works for them, that's great. But I think there's a lot of value for you and your kid in having some distance and having some interests that don't sort of tie into each other all the time. So I think, you know, being a writer, my son has watched me pursue something that I'm passionate about and succeed at, and that a creative life is something to value. You know, he gets to watch his other mom, you know, literally save people's lives, which is pretty awesome. you know, but there's value in all of our jobs. And I think having kids see you enjoy things and also just enjoy something. Like, I know everybody's into like the side hustle these days, and everything has sort of has to get stacked on to have some sort of purpose or meaning to it in terms of making money. But I think there's just a simple joy in showing your kids that, like, I like making this stuff. I like writing these things. And that's enough. You know, not everything that they have as a hobby or an interest has to mean something to someone else. As long as it means something to them, you know, that's what matters. You know, I do homeschool my son. And so, you know, we're together a lot. And I'm really fortunate because we have a good relationship. We get along well. For two people that spend a lot of time with each other, you know, we're in a pretty good place, knock on wood. So having some space where he can be a teen and do his thing, and I can be a writer or a potter or whoever and do my thing, I think that can be valuable to a lot of parents. Especially when, as you pointed out, Casey, you know, your brain is fried and you can't think anymore, even when they're little. Just having a different identity that lets you sort of step out of that parent mode for a little bit can be really helpful and just a break.
Anne, tell me about Beyond Any Experience.
It's women's fiction. It's coming out May 31st. I just got the publication date a couple of days ago, which is exciting, and a cover, which I'm really happy with. I'm publishing with Nine Star Press, which is a small LGBTQ publisher. They're sort of a subset of publishing that I think some people aren't always aware of, that a lot of particularly queer women, but I mean, gay men as well, when they haven't been able to get into trad pub, they've been publishing a lot of really strong independent writers for a long time. Some of the, back then it was mostly lesbian publishing, goes all the way back to like the Naiad days and the feminist bookstores and that kind of stuff. We're many years later now, but a lot of those publishers are still going strong or have morphed into other ones. So that's who I'm with. And it has a middle-aged woman as the lead, because that's kind of where I land these days. And she is a widow raising her son alone, sort of trying to process the grief still around losing her wife, and then meet someone new and sort of has to decide, you know, she knows she really cares for this woman, but can she sort of take that risk and that step again to really commit to another person having lost what she's lost? And one of the complicating factors is that her son is autistic. And so, you know, her freedom to sort of date and leave the house and move around is limited, as it would be for any single parent. And integrating another person into the sort of small world she's kept for her and her son since the loss of her wife is challenging for her. And the book kind of explores what happens when sort of this need to move past this incident collides with the grief that she just hasn't fully handled yet. When frustrated, Olivia's son doled out words the way a miser handed over coins, one at a time and with a begrudging curtness. So she read him by the semaphore of his body and the tenor of his movements. Today, the angry clatter of silverware sounded the first warning. Setting the table usually soothed Ben. He loved a fork lined up on its napkin, a plate rim unmarred by chips. This chore needed no prescribed checklist, no adult confirmation. He could see for himself it had been done correctly, and he orchestrated it to the particular rhythm of his internal metronome. A cabinet door slammed, and she twitched. Chair legs growled against hardwood. Huffing through his nose, Ben fussed with his glass, centering it on the line where the table leaves met. Even the way he flopped into his chair, toes scraping the floor in irritated sweeps, broadcast his discontent. She piled fettuccine Alfredo on his plate and sank into her seat. Silence settled around them. Tempting. Easy. They had passed wordless meals more times than she liked to admit in the 3 years since her wife's death. At first, quiet dinners provided a fragile oasis after hours of grief-fueled rages. Now, on some days, speech was simply beyond them. Ben drained by the cajoling at school and therapy to use his words, and Olivia numbed by phone calls and meetings at work.
So what inspired you to write this particular story?
I'm going to go with that like really traditional writer's response where it popped in my head. The initial impetus, I think, was my wife and I, because she's a doctor, we have kind of serious conversations sometimes about death, maybe, you know, more than some people do. And we were just doing this thing where, you know, something happens to me, I want you to find someone else. And both of us had the same, which is like, okay, no, you know, like not going to happen. You know, I could never get that lucky twice. But obviously, very genuinely, both of us would want that for the other person if something was to happen. And so it just got stuck in my head, like, what would that even look like? Like, if you have this really great, wonderful relationship and you lose it, how do you get past that and then possibly create something else and something else that could be wonderful? And I just couldn't get the question out of my head. And then the story kind of evolved around that. And I took pieces and parts of being in Chicago, and we have a lot of immigrant friends, and the woman she falls for is Mexican-American, and kind of integrating more and more of those characters that you just don't get to see, even in the queer world, frankly. You know, we can still be pretty white for the most part and pretty abled. And so I wanted to take some of those storyline ideas and then extrapolate them out into kind of a more diverse world than you might normally see. A world that I frankly have lived in, you know. Again, it's that whole thing with reading, you want to find yourself and not just yourself, but like the worlds you inhabit and that you recognize.
Jasmine and I both currently lean toward writing nonfiction, especially when it comes to the topic of parenting. So we asked Anne what it is that drew her to tackling a fiction novel with how personally its subject matter is inspired from her own life.
I'm just a longtime reader of fiction. I've come into nonfiction and memoir more in my like 30s and 40s. And I love those as well. But the main reason I don't is so much of my story is tied up in my son's story, and I don't feel comfortable putting his story in a book without his consent and control. You know, I think everyone who writes memoir or personal essays has to sort of find that line or that balance of how much they're willing, you know, to share. I do think there are personal essays I could write, you know. Short stories are really intimidating, can I just say? From a fiction point of view, they're like a whole different beast. But a personal essay, sure. Even a memoir, sure. I mean, I don't mean that dismissively, but like, yes, you know, I think the material is there. If I decided to do it, I would probably only do it when my son was an adult and I would talk about it with him and then just say, I was thinking about writing about this. What do you think? But that's the main reason. So I take slices of things that I've experienced and then fictionalized it, you know, and put it into other people's experiences, other characters, I should say, along with just really enjoying fiction. And since I don't see myself in fiction, I have this urge, not myself particularly, but like my experiences aren't really there yet. So why not write it?
In an interview, you said the best things in my life have come unexpectedly. Can you tell me more about that?
Like I was referencing, I guess, I suppose my wife and my son both ways, but my wife and I were not, she was in Chicago, I was in California, and we jokingly say we met in the dial-up modem days because that's what we had. And there were very basic chat rooms. I mean, no pictures, no anything, just words back then, where if you were coming out, you could try to find other people who were coming out and support each other. And we met in this, it's like a little gray box. And you just type, you know, I mean, it's almost like texting in person, basically, back in the day. And we just met purely accidentally in this chat room. And we're just like, you seem really smart and nice and funny and, you know, stood out. We each stood out to each other in the chat room. And I mean, what are the odds that a med student who's like barely awake at 3 a.m. or whatever gets on a chat, you know, and then I'm on the same chat and then we meet, you know, and 21 years later, we're still together. She's why I moved to Chicago. And then, you know, our son is adopted, but we went in always committed to an open adoption so that he could know his birth parents and have that experience. So that was all planned, but they warn you when you're gay, you know, like it could be a year or two. It's always longer for gay couples. They're trying to like set your expectations so that you don't get too crushed if it doesn't move as quickly as you would like. And adoption is difficult in terms of timing for anybody. And literally a month after we turned in our paperwork, they're like, oh, this couple picked you. And we're just like, holy crap, you know, and very unexpected. So I really feel like I was just someone probably who feels this, thinks this way would say like I was open to it in the moment and that's what allowed it to come in. I don't know if that's the case or not, or if it's just if you land in the right place at the right time, you meet the right person. You know, I'm not religious and so I don't tend to lean that way. But if something made me believe in fate, it would be meeting my wife, because it just seems so inexplicable that we found each other in such an early tech era. I mean, that was back in the era. I mean, and it was like where if you bet someone online, they were probably going to kill you. You know, like, everyone's just like, you what? Like no one had ever met anyone online because that's not what you did, you know?
Right.
You know, and so the fact that we even met that way. So that's what I meant by that. And in some ways, the book was very unexpected. It was just a plot idea that like a question I couldn't get answered that I had to keep thinking about. And it turned into a story. And I didn't expect necessarily to start or even finish a book. But once I got in there, I had to get it out somehow.
What advice do you have for writer parents?
Bedtimes. I know this seems real like low level, but we were big believers in bedtimes. I still am. Our son went to bed early and often and on time. And I think that is the key for writers, for relationships, for everything. And obviously everybody's trying to make their own situation work. And I get that. I'm just saying what worked for us was like bedtimes. I always say they're more for parents than for kids. And if your kid's in bed and asleep at 7, you've got a whole evening in which you can be with your spouse and get some writing done, theoretically, or watch Netflix, whichever. But, you know, you can take some time for yourself is kind of what that leads to. It's so different because it depends on what everyone's writing. Like if you're writing a children's book, having children can be such an inspiration, right? You know, or mm-hmm. middle grade, maybe you're writing it for your middle grade kids so they can see themselves and not you necessarily. But I think it's if you've got only a limited time to write and you're a parent, write what you want to write, I guess would be my best advice. Like, don't write the thing that someone tells you will sell. Don't write the thing that everyone else is writing because it's trendy or someone on Instagram is making it look cool or whatever it is. You know, like, what do you want to write? Because you've only got so much time, right? You're a parent. How many hours a week can you write? Why waste it on something you don't want to do or you don't feel passionately about? And I would definitely say if you can find community, it's really helpful. You know, different people live in small towns in the middle of nowhere or whatever. But even if it's an online group, some sort of social support where they understand that you're trying to be creative and support that can be really helpful.
Time for rapid fire questions.
What were your son's first words?
Oh, goodness. I see you've asked a parent of a teenager this. I mean, I think mama or mom was, you know, I think it was mama first, which is my wife. And then he learned the word light really early. He couldn't say the L, but he knew the word. And star. Which he called tar because he couldn't do the S, but light, star. And then he kind of learned pretty early camera, but he would say camera, but he didn't want to say me to take his picture. He wanted to learn how it worked, which is very on brand for my son. And printer, you say pinter. He got very excited when he figured out at 3 how to like click something on the computer and make it go to the printer. He thought that was really fun.
What was the first thing you said when you saw your son?
I don't know. I didn't really have words, I don't think. I think I've said something about it. He's so purple. There weren't a lot of words at the beginning. It was just more like in the moment kind of. I can't think of a specific thing necessarily. It was just more of an experience than words.
Mm-hmm. Can you read the first words of your current project?
Pinched between Aggie's thumb and forefinger, the Polaroid shimmers with a nostalgic patina. Its boxy white frame, a blunt but reassuring instrument. This far and no farther, hemming in the decades-old image. The memory of watching it develop still exists in her mind, or at least the romantic ideal does. A soft white nothingness dissipating as vague shapes rise from the chemical mists.
Okay, now I'm going to read a series of words to you, and I want you to tell me the first word that comes to mind when I say each word. Change.
Interesting.
Ruminate.
Reflective.
Home.
Love.
Recharge.
Rest.
Fire.
Heat.
Rewrite.
Work.
Heart.
Hope.
You've been listening to First Words. You can find out more info on this episode's guest and the show on our website, firstwordspodcast.com. If this show resonated with you, please share it with other writer parents in your life. We're in this together. First Words is recorded, edited, and co-produced by James Hilmer.